Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. If you'd like to be on the air with us, you can do so using your telephone. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or about your own faith, even if it's different than the Christian faith, we can talk about that here. Maybe you are a person who has objections to the Bible or to Christianity, would like to raise those. I'd be glad to talk to you about any of that kind of thing. If you have a difference of opinion from the host, you're welcome to balance comment. Now, our lines are all wide open. If you tried to call a few minutes ago, you found them busy. They were all set busy, but now they're open. And you can reach me right now and for the coming hour at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And tonight, I'm going to be in a home meeting where I do generally meet on Thursdays when I'm in town. Sometimes I'm traveling, and so we don't have the meeting. But I am home in Santa Cruz for the next few weeks, actually, surprisingly. And that means for the next few Thursdays, including tonight, we have our home group, which is an open Bible discussion and fellowship in a home. You're welcome to join us if you live in the area. Even if you don't live in the area and you've got a Learjet, you want to fly in, feel free to join us here in Santa Cruz tonight. It's actually in Aptos. And if you'd like directions to the meeting and you don't know where it is, you can go to our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. And when you click on the link that says announcements, you will find the information you need. Now, if you don't have internet access, there are still a few people out there who don't. You can call this number to get information. It's area code 831-851-0444. So it's 831-851-0444. And you can call for directions or you can just go to the website. And I think, I'm not even sure the address might even be there at the website. I'm not real sure. Let's talk to Susie, first of all, from Monterey, California today. Susie, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I just enjoy talking to you again. I work in the afternoon, different schedule, so I don't have a chance to really listen or to be on the phone. But I just wanted to ask you a question, and I'll take my answer on the air. I just heard this, what's up with the red letter Christians? I heard there's a type of Christian that just observed the teaching of Christ, and they're called the red letter Christians. Have you heard of this?
Well, you said you want to take the answer over the air. Do you want to stay on the line?
I'll hang up.
Okay.
I'll hang up and let you answer. Thanks, Steve. Bye-bye.
Okay, Susie. Thanks for your call. Bye now. I don't know that I've ever heard anyone referred to as a red-letter Christian, but since you explained what you meant, I can see what is referred to. There are some Christians, I suppose, who don't accept any part of the New Testament except what Jesus said. That is, they figure we're disciples of Jesus. And so just what Jesus said is what they follow. Now, of course, since some Bibles print the words of Jesus in red letters and the rest in black letters, that would, I suppose, give a reason to call these people red letter Christians. They only go by the parts of the New Testament that are in red letters, which is the words of Jesus. This is a mistake, I believe, on their part, although I think the world would be a fine place and probably the Christian church would be 100 times better than it is if Christians would just go by the red letters, because most Christians don't. Most Christians don't follow the teachings of Jesus very, very carefully. And I think, imagine what the world would be like or what the church would be like if the Sermon on the Mount alone became the true rule for life for people who say they follow Jesus. But the problem is there's no reason to limit oneself to what is found in the red letters, because what is written, for example, about Jesus is not in red letters. Matthew and Mark and Luke and John are not Jesus, but they told the story of Jesus. And, you know, if you don't read the black letters in their books, then you won't have any way of knowing who Jesus even is. You'll see his words in red, but you won't know who he is or what he did. You wouldn't know about his death and resurrection as an atonement, although Jesus did make reference to the fact that he was going to die and rise again. You wouldn't know about the miracles of Jesus so much. I mean, obviously, there's more than just the red letters there to inform us. And when we come to the Acts of the Apostles and the history of how the apostles spread the gospel and what they preached and what they did, I can't imagine that not being of value to any Christian. I'm thinking particularly of the writings of the apostles in the epistles, like Paul and Peter and James and John and their writings in the epistles. I'm sure that when some people call themselves red-letter Christians, if they call themselves that, what they're primarily trying to do is distance themselves, possibly, from the teachings of Paul. Paul wrote most of the books of the New Testament. And obviously he never even walked with Jesus. And he taught things which some people have had a hard time harmonizing with the teaching of Jesus. It's often pointed out that Jesus' main emphasis of his teaching was the kingdom of God. And while Paul talked about the kingdom of God, Paul seemed to emphasize much more the issue of forgiveness of sins and atonement and justification by faith and things like that. Now, Paul did talk about the kingdom of God, but his emphasis seems to be in many cases on justification. Whereas Christ sometimes talked about justification, but mostly talked about the kingdom of God. And because of this difference in emphasis, some people have thought there was some conflict between what Paul taught and what Jesus taught. I find no conflict whatsoever. If one author emphasizes one true point and another person emphasizes another true point and both acknowledge the truthfulness of the other party's points, then there's no contradiction. There's simply a different stress being laid on one thing by one person than by the other. But if a person says, well, I'll follow what Jesus said and not what Paul said, they're going to have to convince themselves that Paul was not chosen by Jesus to be a spokesman. Because you cannot accept Jesus and reject the spokesman that he appointed to speak for him. I mean, obviously, if I leave home and tell my younger children to listen to and follow the directions given by my oldest children, and they reject that, they don't listen to their older siblings, well, then they're rejecting me because I'm the one who told them to listen to them. Now, according to Paul, he was met by Christ on the road to Damascus, and Christ appointed him to be an apostle to the Gentiles. And if that is true, that means Paul is an official emissary that Jesus selected to be his spokesperson to the Gentiles. Now, I'm a Gentile, and if Jesus chose Paul to be a spokesperson to the Gentiles, then Paul speaks to me for Christ. And if I reject what Paul says, then I'm in fact rejecting the authority of Christ in my life, no matter what I say to the contrary. One of the things that is in red letters, in those red letter Bibles, is what Jesus said in John John chapter 20, he said to his disciples, as the Father has sent me, so send I you. Also in John 13:20, Jesus said, whoever receives him that I send, and I believe that means in terms of an apostle that he sends, because the word apostle means a sent one. Whoever receives him that I send receives me. So if you do not receive Paul and his authority, or Peter or James or John's or any of them, then you must argue that they are not apostles. That's a hard case to sustain, given the evidence. And so I would be, of course, against the presuppositions of those who are the red-letter Christians. I'm certainly in favor of us following the red letters. But the black letters that Paul and James and John and Peter wrote in the book of Hebrews, they certainly, they're apostolic. They are written by people whom Christ sent. And that being so, you can't reject those and still be following Christ. You'd have to be saying, Jesus, I believe what you said about everything, except about my need to follow those that you sent, like Paul. That's kind of being selective, and that's what Christians are not really consistent if they do. Let's talk to Debbie from Henderson, Nevada. Hi, Deb. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve, and thanks for your time today.
Sure.
I just have a question, and I can also take it off the air so that someone else can get in. I just noticed something last couple of years, but I've also noticed it even more so frequently, and it's also happening in the United States. The calendar is being changed from going from Sunday to Saturday, where the days go Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday,
uh-huh.
Friday, Saturday, to now Monday to Sunday. And
really?
It's especially prevalent in Europe. Now, you know, I'm a Sabbath keeper, and
uh-huh.
I do believe that the sixth day is the holy sanctified day that the Lord set aside for us.
You mean the seventh day?
With him, you know, and is the seventh day. And, of course, there are
yeah.
about 160 languages that if you translated it would say Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a to me, I'm trying to understand, what are they trying to make the seventh day the Sabbath? I mean, what is it that they're trying to do? And I'd love to get your impression on that. Thank you so much, Steve.
Okay, Deb, thanks for your call. Well, I'm not even familiar with that trend. I guess I don't see that many calendars. I'm pretty sure all the calendars I have in my house, the day begins, the week begins with Sunday and ends with Saturday. So that's the conventional way of looking at it, and it's the biblical way of looking at it. Saturday is the seventh day. It's the Sabbath. And I haven't seen these new calendars, but if they are changing it, I'm not sure why they are, unless it's just a matter of convenience for them to reflect the work week as primary, and the 2 days at the end of the week, the weekend, as they were putting them at the end, so they'd have Monday through Friday, if this is what they're doing, and then putting, they're making Sunday then the seventh day. I'm sure that this does not reflect any desire on anyone's part to make Sunday the Sabbath. Well, as far as that goes, I mean, the church, at least a very large portion of the church, perhaps the majority, has been treating Sunday as if it is the Sabbath for almost 2,000 years. Of course, Sunday is not the Sabbath, but nonetheless, if somebody was going to change the calendars to reflect Sunday as the Sabbath day, it seems like that would have been done a long time ago, especially back when those who set the calendars were, you know, influenced by Christian ideas, or at least by religion. Nowadays, those who make calendars, I'm sure, are entirely secularized, and I don't think they're trying to make any determination about what day is the Sabbath or not, because secular people don't observe any kind of a Sabbath. So my guess is that it's not some kind of deliberate attempt to obscure Saturday as the Sabbath, since I don't know that many people in the secular world have any awareness even of Saturday being the Sabbath. So I'm thinking it's probably just a logistical thing, because people probably are so secular now that their work week is what is prominent in their mind. So they start the calendar with the first day of the work week, and then they put the weekend at the end. I'm guessing that's true. Again, not having seen or investigated this trend, that would be my gut feeling for it. Now, of course, if a person is a Sabbath observer, that is a Sabbath observer like yourself, that could be seen as much more sinister than perhaps it is intended to be by those doing it. I know that Seventh-day Adventists, for example, believe that a time is coming when the governments will enforce the observance of a Sunday Sabbath. I seriously doubt that that will happen, and there's certainly no biblical reason to think it's going to happen, except if I was a Seventh-day Adventist following the teachings of Ellen G. White, she said it was going to happen. So if I thought she was authoritative, then I guess I would think that. But since I don't see her as authoritative or as a prophetess, I can't find any biblical reason to think that any government will ever make the Sabbath day Sunday. If I believed that, I would certainly look at this trend and say, wow, look at this. You know, there's kind of an official change in the calendars to make Sunday like the seventh day. But like I say, since the governments of this world, at least in the Western world, are almost entirely secular and trying to avoid all taint of any kind of religion, I doubt that there's any kind of motivation like that going on in their minds. But I don't know. Maybe I'll hear more about this as time goes on, and I'll learn something else. I appreciate your call, Deb. Those are my thoughts. Let's talk to Bob from Portland, Oregon next. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Bob? Did we lose our connection with Bob? Sounds like we did. We'll move along then. We'll talk next to who's been here longest, Mark from Beaverton, Oregon. Mark, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I actually called with a different question, but your last call got me to change what I want to talk about, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe if there's time, I can ask my other question after. But I used to be very involved with the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they taught, which I thought was very interesting about the whole Sabbath thing, is I'm not sure where it is, I believe it's in Revelation, talking about the Antichrist, saying that he will seek to change the times and the laws. Are you familiar with that verse?
That's in Daniel. That's in Daniel, I think, chapter 11, yeah.
Okay, and they were extrapolating that to mean that the Catholic Church has taken the Ten Commandments and split the last one and removed the one about the Sabbath. Are you familiar with that?
I am very familiar with that, yes.
Okay. What do you think about that kind of reasoning?
Well, first of all, the Roman Catholic Church did not remove the Sabbath from the Ten Commandments. They removed the command about making graven images.
So
the Sabbath remains in every version of the Ten Commandments that's ever been published by any Christian group. but the Seventh-day Adventists do believe that Daniel is referring to the papacy or the Roman Catholic Church changing the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. And they say that's what Daniel's referring to when he talks about this evil personage seeking to change times and seasons. There's actually a quotation I've read from one of the popes of the past who actually said, "We have the power to change times and seasons, we the papacy." So, that's a very interesting thing. I am not averse to the idea that those passages could be referring to the papacy, at least some of them. I don't believe that all the passages that the Seventh-day Adventists use, or even that the Reformers used, which they applied to the papacy, I don't think all those passages do apply to the papacy, really. But some do, I think. I mean, at least it seems very possible. And certainly the fact that the papacy actually claimed that very power is somewhat ominous and mm-hmm. somewhat indicative of something. So, you know, I'm not going to dispute that with them. However, what they're suggesting, of course, is that it was a very evil thing for the church to eventually begin having their primary worship day Sunday instead of Saturday, because Saturday is the Sabbath.
Right.
But the papacy didn't have anything to do with that change. The early Christians were meeting on Sunday as early as the 2nd century. That's at least 4 centuries before the first pope came along.
Mm.
Justin Martyr gives a description of the early church services in the early 200s, the early 2nd century, early 100s, early 2nd century. And he said that they commonly met on the first day of the week, which was called the Day of the Sun or Sunday. That was the day they typically met. And apparently they did so because that was the day that Jesus was regarded to have risen from the dead, and so they began to celebrate that day. Nonetheless, they still knew that Saturday was the Sabbath. So they didn't change the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. They just changed the day of the primary day of meeting from the Sabbath to Sunday. And mm-hmm. since it really doesn't matter, biblically, it doesn't matter what day you get together. The Sabbath law was essentially that you don't do any work on the Sabbath. It was about cessation. In fact, the word Sabbath means cessation. Cessation of work, resting. And so the Sabbath was about resting, not primarily about going to meetings. True, the Jews were told to go to meetings on the Sabbath. That was a secondary thing that they were told to do. But see, Christians can go to meetings every day of the week if they wish to. There's not a day of the week where Christians are commanded to go to meetings or to not. Going to meeting, actually, wherever two or more are gathered in Christ's name, there he is. So every time a Christian family says a prayer at a meal, you know, they are in a sense in a Christian meeting, not a formal one, but gathering as Christians happens daily in various settings, or at least multi times per week. So I've never really understood why the Seventh-day Adventists feel that it's so important to go to a meeting on Saturday. Now, if they want to say that we shouldn't work on Saturday because it's the Sabbath, I could understand where they're coming from on that. Though I disagree, because I don't believe the New Testament places Christians under the Sabbath commands of the Old Testament.
Right. I agree with that, too. That's fascinating stuff. Do you have time for one more question?
Perhaps. Go ahead.
Okay. I was watching have you seen the 1977 film Jesus of Nazareth?
Yeah, so many times, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it for the first time last night, and I really liked it. And did you enjoy it, too?
That was Franco Zeffirelli's film, was it?
Yeah,
I thought so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't say I've watched it all the way through many times. I've seen it all the way through, but I've seen parts of it many times. Yeah.
Okay. This idea came to me. I hadn't never really thought of it before, but when Jesus was raised and they found the tomb with the stone rolled away.
Yeah.
Now, we know that Jesus could have exited the tomb without rolling the stone away, because we know that he was able to appear
Right.
In the upper room without opening the door, so he could pass through walls or teleport or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Why have you ever thought about why he didn't just leave the stone intact? Because that would have given people.
It's commonly suggested by those who address that question,
mm-hmm,
that the purpose of moving the stone was to allow the disciples to see inside that the tomb was empty. Jesus could get out any way he wanted to, and the Bible actually doesn't describe him moving the stone. It describes angel. An angel came down and moved the stone.
Oh.
There's no passage in the Bible that describes Jesus actually rising. I mean, it mentions that people saw him after he had risen, but there's no description of the event itself, which is, by the way, one of the many evidences that the Gospels are authentic, because if they were mythological, certainly the most important event of Christianity, the resurrection of Christ, would have been described as some kind of an incredibly glorious event with as much, pizzazz as a mythological writer could put upon it. But the authors of the Gospels never even gave any description of the event of Jesus rising, for the simple reason that they didn't see it, and they were only writing what they really saw. They were writing authentic stuff, so they didn't make stuff up. No one was there to see Jesus rise, but they were there to see that the tomb was empty. And they would not have been able to see that if the angel hadn't moved the stone for them. And by the way, of course, many people saw Jesus alive and even touched him afterwards. So there's the evidence of his resurrection is, as it says elsewhere in the book of Acts, chapter 1, it says many infallible proofs of his resurrection were given.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think the stone was moved for the sake of observers.
Okay.
Because remember, it had a government seal on it. It had a Roman seal on it, which means that no civilian could move the stone without incurring some kind of legal prosecution. And so that the stone was moved not by human agency made it possible for people who would not have the guts to move it to actually walk and find it already open and go and see what's going on in there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I wasn't questioning the authenticity of it. I just sometimes think deeply about certain things, and I thought, like, because some people were doubting, saying, oh, someone must have moved it, the stone, and taken the body out, and I thought if the angel didn't move the stone, it would have been more of a proof that he got out without the stone being moved. And I thought, why did he do that?
But no one could prove that the tomb was empty then.
Well,
it just remained permanently sealed.
Oh, they wouldn't have been able to move it out of the way themselves.
No, it was illegal. It had a government seal on it. It was,
okay,
sealed by Roman authority. Yeah.
Okay, I get what you're saying. Okay, well, thank you very much. Interesting.
Okay, Mark, good talking to you.
You too. Bye.
Okay. Yeah. Now, he mentioned the movie Jesus of Nazareth, made in 1977 by Franco Zeffirelli. The very best Jesus movie I think I've ever seen, at least the one that I find Jesus most authentic and most attractive, is the newest Jesus movie that I know of that came out, and that's the Gospel of John. I don't know how many of you have seen that. The guy who plays Jesus is a guy from this TV series Lost. And I've never watched Lost, but it makes me want to because I like this guy. I like the guy who plays Jesus, and he did, I thought, an excellent job, at least as I picture Jesus behaving and so forth. I don't enthusiastically recommend very many Jesus movies. Not that I'm against them. But most of them are a little, my reaction to them is a little blasé. But I enthusiastically recommend this movie, The Gospel of John. And it only came out a few years ago. But it's, when I saw it, I think I've seen all the Jesus movies out there, except I never saw The Last Temptation of Christ. That's not an authentic Jesus movie. But the ones that are made, that are respectful to Christ and seeking to follow the Gospels, there's been some that are better and some that are worse, but you can rent the Gospel of John through Netflix or, at Blockbuster or whatever. And if you haven't, I think you should see it. It's a very, very good Jesus video. Let's talk to my friend John in McMinnville. Hello, John. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, my brother?
Good. Long time no hear.
Yeah, it's been a little bit. Yeah. Hey, first I thought I'd mention that that term, red letter Christian. Just for reference, someone who has popularized that term quite a bit is Tony Campolo.
I didn't know that.
He's really employed that term a lot. It's kind of funny because it seems like more than just as much as anybody. It seems like, you know, 50% of the time I'm like, yeah, amen, Tony, amen. And the other 50% of the time I'm like, man, he needs to read more of those red letters.
Yeah. I like Tony Campolo. I do. I think he said some pretty powerful things.
Yeah.
But I haven't agreed with everything I've heard him say.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I'm interested to talk with you a little bit about the idea of prophecy. You know, we've talked about this a lot in the past, and, you know, we've been on the same page, you know, for the most part on prophecy. You know,
you mean the gifts of prophecy today,
Yeah, the gift of prophecy.
Was that? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm so torn with that one because, you know, I believe in prophecy, and I want to be receptive to it. Yet, of course, because of the abuses of it in the past, I'm so tempted to be cynical, you know, because I've just been familiar with it since, of course, when it really started to come into full swing in the late 80s and early 90s with schools of prophecy and whatnot.
And
so many people practicing and stuff. It's funny because my old pastor used to joke about that. It's like, I don't know, can they be wrong or not? I don't know, just don't practice on me.
Don't practice being a prophet on me. Yeah, wait till you're better at it.
And I've always agreed with you with the idea of a prophet not being wrong. Yet there is something that came to my mind recently, and it has to do with 1 Corinthians. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. 1 Corinthians 14:19, when it says that let two or three prophets speak and let the others pass judgment. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then, of course, the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. And if I recall correctly, I think that you're leaning towards spirits they're referring to prophecies.
Yeah, the words of the prophecies.
The words
of
the prophecies. And, you know, that kind of stood out to me. I thought, well, why are they passing judgment there? Does that indicate the possibility of it not being accurate? What are your thoughts there?
Well, John, I've heard that suggested, especially back in the, you know, early 90s when there was controversy over the schools of the prophets in Kansas City and so forth. And they often brought that point up. But my own thought is there's a couple ways to look at it. One is that, you know, not everyone who thinks they're a prophet really is a prophet. And when Paul says, let the prophet speak two or three and let the others judge, he may be saying everybody who is thought to be a prophet, you know, I mean, who really is and who really isn't has to really be judged. But anyone who thinks they have a prophecy from God, let them share it. And you know, he may be calling them prophets in the sense that, you know, that's what they are regarded to be until they are judged otherwise, but without really saying that they're all true prophets. I think of 1 John 4:1, where it says, beloved, do not believe every spirit. And by that, he means prophetic utterance, but test the spirits, whether they are of God. He says, for many false prophets have gone out into the world. So it sounds like John is saying you need to test prophecies because some of those people out there prophesying are false prophets rather than real prophets. He doesn't say you need to test all the prophecies because even true prophets may go wrong sometimes. But he says because there's many false prophets. So I don't know, you know, in a place like Corinth, there might have been a lot of people who were maybe not even true Christians. There's a lot of immorality. There's a lot of sophistry. There was a lot of emphasis on spiritual gifts. There were pagan temples, so there might have been people coming in who thought themselves Christians or pretended to be Christian prophets and spoke. And it may be that Paul's thinking, you know, everyone who says they're a prophet who speaks might not really be one, and so people need to judge to the point where they actually, if something's revealed to someone who's sitting by judging, the man who's speaking has to hold his peace and stop talking. I mean, there is a possibility that a person who is a true prophet doesn't always speak accurately, but that'd be a dangerous position to take. Now, see, we think of Nathan the prophet, who was talking to David apparently in the living room just casually one day, and David said, you know, I'm thinking about building a temple for God, and Nathan said, do it. Nathan said, do it. That the Lord is with you in what you're thinking of. Now, he didn't say, thus saith the Lord. He didn't prophesy. But just in conversation with his friend David, he said, hey, that's great. God's in it. And as Nathan was leaving, you know, God came to him and said, Nathan, I didn't tell you to say that. I'm not telling David to build a temple. You go back and tell him it's not going to happen. So Nathan had to come back and actually speak in the name of the Lord, whereas initially he was just apparently given his own opinion. Now, he was a true prophet, but he was capable of giving a wrong opinion. And apparently a prophet needs to be able to distinguish whether he's really giving the word of the Lord or whether he's just, you know, speaking his own heart. And maybe the church needs to be aware of that too. I'm not one who says that as soon as someone gives a prophecy that's flaky, that they shouldn't be able to prophesy anymore. But if somebody is holding the office of a prophet or professing to be a contender for that office, I would think they have to be reliable all the time. Because you know, John, that I make a distinction between simply prophesying on the one hand and holding the office of a prophet on the other. I think that when Paul said you may all prophesy, even he tells all the Christians, covet the best gifts, especially that you may prophesy. You know, it sounds like prophesying is something that every Christian may aspire to. But he says later on in chapter 12, actually beforehand in chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians, says, are all apostles, are all prophets, you know, are all teachers? The answer, of course, he implies is no. Not everyone is a prophet, but everyone might prophesy, possibly. So I would say that the concern here is that no one should be regarded to be a prophet genuinely until they've been tested sufficiently to really have a track record of showing that they really are right when they prophesy. Short of that, any member of the congregation might sense that they have a prophecy, and they might even be wrong. And there's a good reason to judge their words as well.
So to your way of thinking, if someone isn't affirmed as in the office of a prophet, if they're just simply giving a word that would be a prophecy, would you grant more latitude towards that person?
Well, I wouldn't call them a prophecy. I wouldn't call them a prophet if they gave a prophecy that was judged to be wrong. I would judge that they had given a word that they thought was a prophecy and that it was disqualified by the judgment of the church from being a prophecy, and therefore that person might still be a Christian. I'm sure, you know, but not a prophet.
Okay.
That'd be my approach.
Well, it's good hearing your thoughts on that. I appreciate it.
Hey, John, good to hear your voice. Good to hear from you again.
God bless you, my brother.
God bless you, too. Bye now. All right, our next call comes from Stan in Las Vegas, Nevada. Stan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, about the red letter Christians. We had a radio program here about that for quite a while here in Las Vegas called Red Letter Christians. It was a different guy, and he made some.
Well, that's probably why Deb called about. She's a Las Vegas caller, I think.
Yes,
too.
Yes, she's a good Seventh Day Sabbath keeper.
Uh-huh.
I have a Bible that has red letters throughout the entire Bible from Genesis through Revelation, in that it has where the Father, the Lord God Yahweh, is speaking in the so-called Old Testament. It is written in red.
Uh-huh.
So that when you read the 12 little prophets, when you read Leviticus, when you read Genesis, or whatever in the so-called Old Testament, when the Almighty Father is speaking, boom, it comes out at you in red.
Uh-huh.
I love this Bible because it helps me as a relatively new believer in the past 4 years to better decipher stuff. For example, in Isaiah, there's some whole chapters in Isaiah that are in red. Where,
oh, I would think so.
I'm sorry?
I would think so. In fact, I would expect that almost the entire book would be in red in that case.
Maybe not, but some entire chapters where maybe just the first sentence of the chapter is in black, and then the entire rest of the chapter is the Father speaking. And mm-hmm. I didn't know this, or it was very hard for me to see this, when I had the standard Bibles, 98% of the Bibles, I think 99% of the Bibles in America in the bookstore, they do not have the Old Testament in red letters like they do in the New Testament where the Messiah is speaking.
I don't know that they would need to, because, I mean, the Bible plainly says when it's God speaking. See, the putting red letters even in the New Testament isn't necessary because when you read the New Testament, you find that when it says Jesus said, well, then you know that what you're about to read is what Jesus said. You don't have to change the color of the letters to know that.
That's very true, but you got to realize you're a 40-50-year Bible scholar. There's some people who are 4 or 5 weeks, 4 or 5 months, 4 or 5 years, and I'm not a dumb guy, but it really helped me to see it come out red in the New Testament, and I exceptionally helped me to see it come out and read in the Old Testament, where I said, oh, this is the Father speaking. You know, this isn't a Hosea. This isn't Moses. This isn't Joseph. This is the Father speaking. So I took note of it. It really helped me immensely.
Okay.
And my question to you is, and to the audience, I believe the reason 99% of the Bibles, they'll do the red in the New Testament, but not in the Old, is it's kind of a residual leftover kind of a Constantine thing of not wanting to keep the Old Testament alive and well. It's kind of what Constantine, you know, wanted to break away from the Old Testament Israelite Hebrew nation and move it away from that. I can't prove this. I wasn't there at the time. But when I've shown this to older Bible scholars in a Bible study group, they love seeing a Bible that has the Father's words written in red in the Old Testament. So
okay.
I
well, let me make some comments about this, because most of the Bibles on my shelf, and I have many, don't have any red letters in them at all. Yeah, most of them don't have any red letters at all in them. And, you know, being a 40-year Bible scholar isn't necessary for you when you're reading through, let's say, the Gospel of Matthew.
Right.
And you're reading that Jesus did this and Jesus did that, and then Jesus opened his mouth and he said these words. You don't need red letters to tell that those are Jesus' words, because they're actually stated to be Jesus'
right,
words. I mean, if you...
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Unless you're the kind of reader that just kind of opens the Bible at random, lets your eyes fall on a certain passage, and you don't read any context, then you might not know whether it's Jesus speaking or not. But see, even reading the Old Testament, I grew up reading the Old Testament and the New as a child, and whenever I came to one of the 4,000 times in the Bible where the author said, "Thus says the Lord." And that, you know, the Old Testament authors said
right.
that a great deal. Or when it says God spoke, or the Lord God said to Abraham, or whatever, you know, they didn't even have to change the cover of letters. I realized that when it said the Lord spoke to Abraham and then it gave what he said, it was not hard to tell what he said.
Okay.
And I'm not sure why anyone would not see that immediately.
Okay, here, I think you're missing the point of my call. You're correct about maybe 80%, 90% of the time where it says, "Thus the Lord spoke," you don't need the red letters. It's there. An idiot could see that, or somebody as simple as minded as me could see that. But there's maybe 10, 20% of the time where it doesn't say, "Thus saith the Lord," and boom, you see it's in red, especially in some of the minor prophets or in the Tanakh and the Psalms and Ecclesiastes, where it doesn't say, "Thus saith the Lord." And when you see that in red, it totally changes your conception and your comprehension of that passage in the context. So I would recommend to you and your audience, go find a Bible that does have the red. I use the Sword Bible, and it does do the whole thing in red, Old and New Testament. And you will see so many times where you would not know that that's the Father himself speaking. And that's my point. That's my point to you.
Okay. If we wouldn't know, then how do the publishers know to put those words in red? If there's nothing in the text that tells us it's God speaking, then how did the publisher who put it in red know that?
You know, that's an excellent question. I've kind of asked that myself. But when you read the whole context, you can then see, looking back, well, that's not Isaiah speaking. That's not Zechariah speaking. That's just sometimes it'll just be two sentences.
I agree. What I'm suggesting is that people should read the whole context. I'm not really one who would advocate people just dropping their eye somewhere on the page and taking whatever verse they hit and just trying to make sense of it.
No, you're missing
I think
the
people
point.
Should read through the Bible, and
they should
read everything in its context.
I'm just trying to say there's so many people who love the red letters in the New Testament. It did help me to see, that's where Jesus is speaking. Because sometimes
I think you've made your point.
But my point is, I think the reason 99% of the Bibles don't come who do the red letters in the New Testament, they don't do it in the Old Testament, is because they have that little residual prejudice against the Old Testament that we see in Constantine and that we see in the Catholic Church.
Well, Stan, I need to take a breath here. I personally have my doubts that that is what motivated people to put the words of Jesus in red. I think that the putting of the words of Jesus in red stems from the Christian idea that Jesus is the Lord, and that what Jesus spoke is what he has instructed Christians to do. Now, you could do the same thing in the Old Testament, but as you say, you'd print whole books in red. I remember once when I was teaching the Great Commission School, we had a student who came in, and he had never read through the Bible before. We taught through the whole Bible in 9 months, and he would highlight with a yellow highlighter everything that struck him in his Bible. And he literally he highlighted every single line. We discovered this by the time we were going through about, you know, Judges or 1 Samuel or something. And I realized that everything we'd covered was highlighted in yellow. And I thought, well, you know, you could save yourself a lot of ink just by remembering that the parts that have black letters are the parts that impress you, you know. Listen, Stan, it doesn't bother me if someone has red letters in the Old Testament and red letters in the New or no red letters at all. There's certainly nothing obligatory in Bible publishers to change the color of any of the letters. But I think the reason that there's a tradition of printing the letters, the words of Jesus in red in some Bibles is because the words of Jesus are considered to be the words, well, that's what we're supposed to teach people to observe. Jesus said, go into all the world, make disciples, and teach them to observe everything I have commanded you. So maybe that's why they did it. Jesus is the Lord. And anyway, I appreciate your comments there. You certainly had enough time to make them. Let's talk to Roger from Las Vegas next. Hi, Roger. Welcome.
Hello. God bless you today.
Thank you.
And say a few things. You know, they're talking about the red letter Christians or whatever it is. There was a show here in town, but it was called the Red Letter Edition, and I haven't heard from that guy. I'm coming to you today is the lady called in about the Sabbath and everything, and I know that we are saved by grace through faith and everything like that there, but we should still follow the Ten Commandments, correct?
The New Testament doesn't say so. The New Testament says we should follow the teachings of Jesus.
Okay, so my question then is in, I believe it's in the NIV, where Jesus says, I think it's Matthew 4:17,
okay.
Something about the you know, the law and the prophets, none of that.
That's
will,
Matthew 5:17, yeah. Matthew 5:17.
Okay.
Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I didn't come to abolish but to fulfill.
Okay, now I'll take the answer of that off the air, but what did he actually mean by that?
Oh, okay. Well, he said that people should not mistakenly feel that he had come to abolish the law. He did not come as an opponent of the law. He said he came as its friend. He came to fulfill it. You know, the law anticipated something. That is certainly taught throughout the New Testament. And the law existed to anticipate something better than itself. The sacrifices that were offered under the law, they anticipated the sacrifice of Christ. The various laws of cleanness and uncleanness and special calendar holy days, they all had symbolic value, as all Christians believed to be the case, and as the New Testament teaches. So basically, the law anticipated something better than itself. The symbolism in the rituals and so forth were symbolizing something that was yet to come. Now, Jesus said, I didn't come to destroy the law. I came to fulfill it. That is, if someone thought that by his behavior he was exhibiting hostility toward the law, and by the way, I'm not sure why anyone would think that unless there were some things Jesus was doing that didn't seem to be consistent with the law in their minds. If Jesus seemed to be breaking the Sabbath, for example, or you know, violating the code of cleanness, as, for example, when he touched a leper or let a woman who had an issue of blood touch him. I mean, Jesus was continually doing things that seemed to be not observing the law. And he anticipated, some people would say, whoa, this Jesus, he's against the law. He is an enemy of the law. And he said, no, don't think that. I'm not an enemy of the law. I'm not here to abolish it. I'm here to fulfill it. It anticipated something, and I'm the one that it was anticipating. Just like he fulfilled prophecy. The prophets anticipated the Messiah. He was the Messiah. He fulfilled them. So he also fulfilled the things that were anticipated by the law. So that's what he means, I believe, when he says he came to fulfill the law. Now, to say that he fulfilled it and didn't abolish it, the next question we would ask, if we want to know how this applies practically to us, is, well, once he has fulfilled it, what is its function then? In other words, before Jesus fulfilled it, it's clear that God commanded Israel to observe all these laws. But now that it has been fulfilled, is that obligation still there? And that's where we'll find some Christians these days who disagree with the mainstream. For many centuries, the view of the church has been that, as Paul certainly taught, that these ceremonial laws were a shadow anticipating Christ. But since he has come, we are no longer obligated to keep those ceremonies. So Paul said no one should be able to judge you whether you keep clean diet or whether you observe festivals or new moons or Sabbath days. He said those things were a shadow, he said in Colossians 2, 16 and 17. They were not the substance. The substance is Christ, he said. So that's what the church has taught for most of 2,000 years. Now, there was a group in the first century called the Judaizers who tried to get the Christians to start observing these rituals again. And Paul wrote a letter against them. It's called Galatians. And he pointed out to the Gentile Christians that anyone who seeks to put them under these rituals of circumcision and keeping ceremonies and so forth, that person is drawing them away from Christ. He said they're preaching a different gospel. He said that those who have followed them have become estranged from Christ and have fallen from grace. Those are the things Paul said to them. Now, what's amazing is that there's a very powerful movement in the evangelical circles, say kind of fringe evangelical circles. And I get a lot of calls from people in this movement. In Las Vegas and the Seattle area, I take it there's a high concentration of this kind of thinking in these areas, because I get a lot of calls from those areas from this kind of people. And they're basically saying the very same things, apparently, that Paul wrote against when he wrote Galatians. But they're trying to reinterpret Paul. It's very funny, almost, to hear the interpretations they give, because they they go a great deal to try to make Paul say the opposite of what he's saying and so forth. But, you know, what they're saying is that the law really hasn't changed because Jesus said he didn't come to abolish it. Well, you can change something without abolishing it. A child changes when he becomes a man, but he doesn't abolish, you know, he's not abolished. He still exists. He's come to maturity. The law anticipated Christ. Childhood anticipates a mature human being. And when that child becomes the mature human being, the childhood has passed and the maturity has come. And that's what Paul said in Galatians 4 is the case with the law. When we were children, we were kept under the law. But when faith came, we became mature sons. And so Paul himself used this illustration that I'm using. That, when I was a child, Paul says, I thought as a child, I acted as a child, I reasoned as a child. But when I became a man, he says, I put away childish things. I didn't destroy myself. I became fulfilled in what was anticipated by my childhood. And so what Christ brought was a fulfillment of what was anticipated by the law. So that's what I understand to be the meaning of that passage. Let's talk to Tom from Oregon City while we still have a few minutes left. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
How you doing, Steve?
Good.
You know, I called in today. I've been on hold for a little while. I've been listening for 20 or 30 minutes, and it's interesting, I find, the theme of topics that have been coming in conjunction with what I have to ask.
Okay.
I have a friend who is a Messianic Jew or Messianic Christian, however you want to put it, and we're having an interesting conversation recently. I've known for a while, and I begin to pick his brain on the fact that he believes that he should be continually following certain rituals, ordinances, or laws of cleanliness when it comes to what's found in the Torah, Law of Moses, and Old Covenant material. And we were comparing notes. I was quoting New Testament, he was quoting Old Testament as well as New Testament, and he seems pretty convicted and believing that it's obligated of him to, at least in some cases, to continue to observe. Now, here's my question. This is nothing new. A lot of people have, just like you stated, been confused over this matter. However, I think that he comes from a slightly different angle. Because he's part Jew by blood, he feels that him or his people are obligated and not necessarily the common Christian. Are you familiar with that movement or those people? He's been influenced by certain individuals and literature and groups and such.
Well,
and
it doesn't matter what your race is. Yeah, it doesn't matter what your race is unless you're a racist. You know, what is racism? Racism is when one person is treated with deference or with disgust because of their race and because of nothing else about them. God is not a racist. He treats everybody the same in terms of, whoever is a believer is saved and whoever is not a believer is lost. Doesn't matter what race they are. They may be black or yellow or red or white, or they may be Jewish or Gentile. God doesn't make distinction between races. That's what Paul says repeatedly. God is not a respecter of persons. And what that means is that God doesn't respect any natural state that a person's in above the natural state of someone else.
Or play favorites.
Yeah, he doesn't play favorites. Now, unfortunately, we live in a time where people have gotten really confused. And I actually think it could be a demonic confusion, because I can't imagine why there's such a large number of Christians today who cannot see what the New Testament teaches in plain black letters. Maybe they only want to read the red letters. But even if they read the red letters, it doesn't matter. The New Testament is very plain on these matters. And yet, when Paul wrote to the Galatians about this, he said, Galatians, who has bewitched you that you have departed from the gospel? Now, it's interesting. The word bewitched means literally has cast a spell on you. He indicated that when people start drifting back into Mosaic observances, when they become Christians, it's like there's a demonic delusion has come upon them. Someone like cast a spell on them. And sometimes I really wonder why so many Christians who have the New Testament available can't see what it says and are so easily persuaded into another movement. But I guess it's just that there's some persuasive teachers who've got an agenda, and they're able to persuade people that Paul didn't mean what he said, that Jesus didn't mean what he said, that the New Testament isn't really the authority the Old Testament is. And, wow, I mean, it's just shocking to me, frankly. It really is shocking to me. I know a number of Christian leaders who've said they believe the Messianic movement is a cult. I haven't usually used that word for it, but it certainly is a distraction from Jesus. I mean, they may think that they're really giving honor to Jesus because they're, putting him in his Old Testament context. No, they're putting the Old Testament in the place of focus where Jesus used to be. And the laws and so forth suddenly become, your religious life is defined by the laws you're keeping instead of by whether you're a disciple of Jesus or not. It's a great concern to me, frankly, when I see this kind of stuff going on. And it is going on big time.
Yeah. What would your personal plea be to such a person who, seems to be, or at least believes in grace and says he's a born-again Christian, but seems to be sidetracked or tied into this belief?
I would say reflect long and hard on the transfiguration and its meaning. Three of the Gospels and one of the Epistles talk about the transformation. It's very important. What is the transformation? It's when Jesus' glory appeared to his disciples, and he was with Moses and Elijah, who represent the law and the prophets. And they gave Jesus their endorsement, and then they faded away. Peter wanted to keep them around. Peter said, let's build three tabernacles, one for Jesus, one for Moses and Elijah. But that was the wrong way to think. It wasn't for Moses and Elijah to stay around. When they disappeared, Jesus alone was left, and a voice from heaven said, this is my son, hear him. In other words, you Jewish disciples, you used to listen to the law and the prophets as your authority. Now this is my son, you listen to him now. And Christians who start going back to the law and the prophets as their guide instead of Jesus, or in addition to Jesus, trying to build three tabernacles, have them all, they're missing the point, I'm afraid. I'm terribly sorry. I've got to end this call so I can get off the air here before they cut me off. I appreciate your call, brother, and all of you who called today. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon on the stations you're listening to. You can also hear the program live or later at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. We are listener-supported, and if you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless. Thank you.